Good morning, everyone, and welcome to a special edition of A Vision for You. My name is Larry Kay, and I live in Chicago. I'm a recovered compulsive overeater, and I'll be the host for the presentation this morning. Today is Sunday, February 16th, 2025. Let me give you the share ID numbers for Friday, February 14th. The 7 a.m. Eastern Standard Time meeting, that number is 22,167. That's 22167. The 10 a.m. meeting on Friday, 22,168. That's 22168. This morning, A Vision for You presents, We Take the Bit in Our Teeth. So, you know, I love the theme of Amy's presentation this morning. We take the bit in our teeth. It's a concept that resonates deeply with those of us in the recovery program. I'm going to do my best to be brief here so we can get to the good stuff here, because I got a commitment made a commitment to get offline a little bit earlier than normal. So we want to make time for Q&A. But, you know, I guess for me, the process is not just about the stopping of our eating, right? That, in fact, the big book tells us just that very thing on page 19. It says, we feel the elimination of our drinking is but a beginning. So rather, it's really about embracing a profound, transformative process of surrender. And that surrender, of course, is not passive. It's characterized by action. And we're going to hear more about that in the 12 steps. They really offer us a structured guidance, a kind of a way to reflect, to confront our past a bit, to build a new future with God's help. You know, we're cultivating a relationship with power, essentially. So what's painstakingly clear for me is, you know, taking the bit in our teeth requires active participation. We'll hear more about that. And it demands that we acknowledge our powerlessness over food while simultaneously reclaiming the God-given agency, this ability to act, agency to change our lives. So, you know, we arrive here for different reasons, the pain and isolation of the disease, but we have a common problem. And, of course, we have a common solution to that problem. We're going to hear about more about that today. And embracing this journey involves a willingness to confront the discomfort, and so, you know, I invite anyone to reflect on what it means to take the bit into your teeth. And with that, you know, joining us this morning to share her personal story of transformation is someone that I think is a great teacher, at least a great teacher of mine. And she's experiences transformation as a result of the 12 steps. And that's Amy G, a recovered compulsive overeater from Maryland. And Amy is dedicated to our 12-step way of life. She's committed to carrying a message of hope to our fellowship. I heard her do a wonderful job in L.A. She's just a great voice for recovery. So it's with great appreciation that we welcome Amy G to the line this morning. Good morning, Amy.
Good morning, Larry. How are you? Good morning.
Can you hear me? I'm good. Okay? Good to hear you. Yeah, I can hear you great. Thanks, Amy.
Great. Just wanted to make sure. Good morning, everyone. And thank you, Larry, so much for that wonderful opening. Right on point, as always. And I'm so grateful to be here. What an honor and a privilege. This program of Overeaters Anonymous, these 12 steps, have literally transformed and saved my life. And I can't wait to drill down on this because I'm a horsey girl. I don't know if some of y'all may know that or not, but I am a horsey girl and I love all of the quotes that refer to anything horsey-like, which was one of the reasons why I begged Leigh to be able to talk a little bit about taking the bit in our teeth. But real quick, let me qualify very briefly, just so you know, I'm one of you all, very much so. I am what I like to call a bottle in the bag, living underneath the bridge, compulsive overeater. I came to Overeaters Anonymous, my first meeting in March of 1983. I was 17 or 18, and I'd love to tell you I got it, and it was all rainbows and unicorns, but unfortunately I did not. And I did become recovered almost 5 years later after torturous relapse and slipping, and I'll get into that, in December of 87. And I have been recovered since that time. And when I say recovered, I mean that the definition of Overeaters Anonymous, refraining from compulsive eating and compulsive food behaviors while working towards or maintaining a healthy body weight. And I always add, as Harlan says, while doing so happily. Never in my wildest dreams did I ever think there would be a time that food did not call to me constantly. Constantly, whether I was eating it or not eating it, whether I was dieting, whether I was on a scale, off a scale, 20 times a day. My top weight was 170. And as I always say, I had the three D's of the disease: denial, delusion, and defiance. So I just stuck my head in the sand. And so I probably was pushing 200 with maybe another pounds or whatever. I'm not exactly sure. Oh, and by the way, there's the other three D's of the disease when you're ready for when you're ready for the program, which is dying, desperate. My anorexic weight was 102. I know that very well, that number. Driving in the summer with the heat on, with a down jacket, basically because there's no fat on my body, about 30 pounds less than what my normal weight is now. And by far and away, my worst manifestation of my illness was the bulimia. What I thought was a magic trick to eat whatever you want and not get fat. That was my dream. That's what I thought I needed, to meet the magic number on the scale and my life would come together like a freaking fairy tale. But what became a way to hopefully fulfill that dream turned out to be a nightmare, where I began purging around the clock, 10 and 12 times a day, difficulty keeping any food down. It was a nightmare. Like I said, I came in at 83. I thought, okay, maybe this is for me. You all mentioned the word God. I got up in the middle of the meeting and I left because I didn't want to have to do anything with God. And thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you. I call it the fellowship with God, you know, fellowship with skin on. Someone followed me out of the meeting and said, you're welcome here. The only requirement for membership is to not want to be crazy with food. And they handed me the pamphlet. We still have it today. 15 questions. Are you a compulsive overeater? And I answered yes to every single one of those questions, and I kept coming back. But it took almost five years of torturous hell, because there were a lot of things I was doing. We're talking about action here and taking the bit in our teeth. And I know we're referring, you know, we just are right now going past the amends, where the quote actually is on page 77. And Bill talks about taking the bit in our teeth, and we go with great resolve, no matter how much we dislike the other person or how much the other person had hurt us, and we go ahead and we get down to it and we move forward and make that amends. And in thinking about this quote and being a horsey person, I'm like, well, isn't taking the bit in our teeth, taking action, something that we have to do every single day in program? I mean, I don't know about you all, but one of my quotes is, you can only coast downhill. Right? This program requires daily action. So I'm not just taking the bit in my teeth for doing my fourth and fifth step, for making my amends, which the big book makes very clear. If we don't do those, we're not going to stay recovered. But don't I take action every single day? And I need to do that, because every day I deal with me. I deal with my thinking. I deal with the addict in me, the ism, the inside me stuff. But I also, so I need to take those actions to stay recovered. So when you think of taking the bit in your teeth, this is actually an old racehorse term. And what that means is that a horse sets his jaw against a bit and then goes for it. Like when you look at the races and you watch the Kentucky Derby, when you see the horse coming around to the stretch, the final turn, you'll see every jockey grab the horse's reins, tighten them up, no slack. They'll sit down low in the saddle. The horse gets the cue, and they take off like crazy for the finish line. And that's that. It's just balls to the wall. Let's see who can get there first. And so this term comes from exercising racehorses, and I did my fair share of that. And what happens sometimes is when you're exercising a racehorse, they think that you're racing. And it is a terrifying experience when you give them the wrong aid and you ever so slightly pick up the reins. They will take the bit in their teeth and they will take off. And they call
Amy, I think I think we lost. Oh, there you go. We got you. You're back.
Yeah, I don't know. For some reason, my it told me to unmute myself. So I'm like, oh my gosh, I don't know how long I've been muted.
No, just now. Just now. We got it. You got it.
Oh, okay, perfect. So basically, what happens when you put a bit in a horse's mouth, it lays in between his teeth. And when he grabs it with his teeth, he becomes uncontrollable. I mean, here's the definition that Bill was using it for the reason, which is refers to a person who is either taking control of a situation, going forward with great force and determination and resolve. Excuse me one second. And that is what Bill was saying in relation to making these amends. But there's also another aspect and a further definition to taking the bit in your teeth that I was talking about. It's either moving forward and taking control of a situation with great force and determination, or it's someone who is uncontrollable and casts off restraint. Someone who is absolutely uncontrollable. And that's what I was talking about. When I was exercising these racehorses and they took off on me, it was absolutely, completely out of my control. There's a great quote going around in OA rooms that they say, compulsive overeating is like dancing with a gorilla. You don't stop dancing until the gorilla stops dancing. And that's what's actually happening when you get a runaway with on a horse. And it's terrifying because they can reach speeds of upwards of 45 miles an hour, 50 miles an hour. And there's no getting off. I tried that once and I destroyed my collarbone doing it. You have to wait till the horse is done or the pickup man comes up and grabs the reins and slows you down. But it is a terrifying experience. And you know, you awake from a binge after a terrifying experience and you meet the other four horsemen, the four terrible horsemen that they talk about on page 151. Fear, terror, frustration, bewilderment. And I think what I struggled with in early recovery, and especially those first 5 years, it's one thing to take action, right? But it's to take the right action that we're talking about here. And I think that I didn't understand who I truly was as a compulsive overeater. I was willing to admit powerlessness, but there were a lot of half measures going on. And sometimes action, you know, if I'm not taking the right action, just spinning my wheels, making smoke, and I'm not going anywhere. And I think page 60 gives me the definition of exactly what it is, who and what I am. It says, our description of the alcoholic, the chapter to the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, God could and would if he were sought. So finally, in 87, I finally surrendered to who and what I am. You know, sometimes action is a decision. The first word is we admitted we are powerless, right? But there's only something me, myself, and I can do, and that is to surrender to who and what I am and take the action steps that are then prescribed. I mean, I tell you, my first 5 years, my first, very first sponsor in Overeaters Anonymous was someone who said in her story, she got up in the middle of the night to binge. And she was going down the hallway, going down the stairs to go down to the kitchen to binge, and the lights flashed on and off. And she said she'd been abstinent, I kid you not, abstinent ever since. And I thought, oh, I'll take that kind of recovery where I don't need to do anything. I just get struck abstinent. And of course, the woman tried to explain to me, God bless all the sponsors I blew through those first 5 years. He tried to explain to me there was more to that, but I was stuck on the just let's strike me abstinent so I don't have to do anything. And that kind of behavior, that kind of attitude led to that kind of action that got me nowhere but in torturous hell and relapse in Overeaters Anonymous. So finally in 87, I surrender. Okay, I say, this is who I am. What do I need to do? And there's a great quote in the big book. It's in the stories of the fourth edition. And it's on page 317 in the chapter, My Chance to Live. And it says here, if asked what the two most important things in recovery are, I would have to say willingness and action. I was willing to believe that AA was telling me the truth. I wanted to believe that it was true in a way I cannot relate in words. I wanted this thing to work. Then I began to take the course of action prescribed. So what is the course of action prescribed? It's putting down the food, defining what my abstinence is, and going through the process of working the 12 steps. I had to know what were my alcoholic or crack ingredients. For me, sugar, high fat, flour, and volume. That was one that took me a while to wrap my brain around, to understand that I could get triggered by volume just as easily as I could when I put my allergic substance. It's, remember, it's refraining from compulsive overeating and compulsive behaviors. So my sponsor said to me, she said, in Overeaters Anonymous, Amy, we don't think our way into new action and new behaviors. We act our way. And that made sense to me. I mean, I know that we all say every action is born in thought. But if my thinking is screwed up, then my actions are going to be screwed up. I mean, step one in the AA 12 and 12 makes it very clear. It says we have warped our minds with such an obsession for destructive eating and or drinking that only an act of providence can restore us. Providence meaning putting the food down and working the 12 steps like my hair's on fire. And that's what exactly we started doing. And we had to define what was abstinent. In AA, they put the plug in the jug. In OA, we need to know what jug to put the plug in. So we had to work on what was abstinence first. And then we got on the business of working the steps. And I want to talk a little bit here about the tools. Because, yes, I can be stark raving abstinent on the tools. But I can't work the steps without the tools. They say the tools are the guardrails, the handrails as we walk up the steps. Because I'm not struck abstinent just because I surrender at step one. Right? I have to work the program and become recovered. So in order to do that, I used the tools as the guardrails as I continued to learn what it was to work these steps abstinently. Entire abstinence. The big book, Doc Ock, make it very clear. I don't eat my way through the 12 steps and find myself abstinent at the end. Right? I put down the food first, and then I move forward through the process of working the steps. Abstinence is actually, the tool of abstinence was actually my first act of surrender, my first act of right action. And then the disciplines of the tools. I don't know about you all, but it was really difficult to learn how to be abstinent, how to get abstinent food. And for the bulimic, I had to use the phone because I had to bookend my meals. I would cry through my meals on the phone saying, there's no way I can keep this food down. I didn't think I could be full without feeling like I'd have to purge. And so I would pick up the phone after a meal if I needed to. Saying, can you please talk to me? I mean, the fellowship is a God with skin on in a huge way. Because if someone had told me in early recovery, go get God, you know, go believe in God, I couldn't have done it. I was completely agnostic. I didn't even understand what that mean. But you all showed me this spiritual program. You all showed my higher power and God to me. Because when I picked up that phone crying, going, I don't think I can keep this meal down. I mean, it brings me to tears now. I would have a recovered fellow say, Amy, yes, you can. Let's pray. Let's do this, right? So I was no longer alone. And the power of that is incredible. When I had to do the fourth and fifth step, I had to take the action using the tools of writing, literature. All of those things required tool work. And as I began to work those steps, my brain started to clear and I started to connect to a power. I mean, the disciplines of using the tools and the steps together. Pain of discipline or pain of regret. Page 88 says, we alcoholics are undisciplined. So for me, early recovery was really about a daily habit, a routine for recovery. I had to eat every single day, right? I had to learn how to be in recovery every single day. And while I was using the tools, I was working the steps with a sponsor and I was going through that process. My connection to God evolved via the process of taking the action that the steps require. The tools helped me take those steps. So to me, it's an all-in program. I'm using the tools. I still do today. I'm working the steps every single day. To me, it's kind of like a wash, rinse, repeat. Wash, rinse, repeat. I mean, repetition is the father of learning. And today I live in steps 10 10 through 12, right? The habit of doing steps 10, I can't even stress how important that was, because once the food stopped calling, thank God, usually somewhere around 8 and 9 around for many of us, but for me, it was around 8 and 9 for sure, because I totally started to see a higher power at that point, God doing for me what I could not do with these amends. And I started to understand how important it was to understand what was going on inside me internally. They say steps 1 through 3 are the first surrender, but steps 4 through 9 is the internal surrender to the internal conflict, to the spiritual malady. And 10, 11, and 12 is constantly combating that spiritual malady for me. You know, every day I'm dealing with my will versus God's will. Is it going to be self today, or is it going to be God's will today? And so there's right action in many ways. So sometimes it's no action. Sometimes for me, one of the most spiritual things I can do today in recovery is to wait on God's will. I mean, I'm impulsive, compulsive, obsessive. That stuff hasn't changed. It's gotten better, but I have learned to pause. I heard this once in a meeting, and I've always repeated it. It says, it's not about the first thought. I'm an addict. My first thought can always be crazy, but it's the second thought and the actions that I take after that that define whether I am recovered or not. So, for example, if I'm very irritated at a situation, let's just say my husband, poor husband, I always use him as the example, right? I'm irritated with my husband and I want to pitch him out the window and I want to say something. Well, the first spiritual discipline is to keep my mouth shut until I can regulate my emotions. And sometimes that means walking away. And then the question is, how am I really dealing with that situation when I keep my mouth shut? Am I clenching my jaw like a horse wanting to run off, thinking to myself, you SOB, if you ever say that to me again, I'm going to draw and quarter you? Or am I thinking to myself while my mouth is shut, praying, going, God, please relieve me of the bondage of self, like a mantra. God, please relieve me of the bondage of self. God, please relieve me of the bondage of self until I can calm down and regulate my feelings and understand what's going on and what's my part. It usually comes down to a fear of some sort, usually. There's a great quote in our sister program, and it says, I can either retreat, reload, and refire, or I can refrain, reflect, and then respond appropriately. Which one do you think works better in a relationship, y'all? Do you know what I mean? I want to live today somewhere between grace, God's grace, willingness, and action. If there's like a triangle, it would be willingness, action, and God. That would be where I would want to live my life. I think some of the most difficult things I can do now in recovery is to wait. That is waiting on the discomfort of God and what God has for me to do versus the pain of regret when I jump to something impulsively. For example, I desperately wanted in recovery about late 20s, 6 or 7 years in. I thought marriage was going to be the cure, just like I thought it was sticking my finger down my throat. And this is in recovery, y'all. And against many people in recovery and out of recovery, I got myself engaged to someone who turned out to be the exact wrong person. But I was more in love with wanting to be married than I was having the right person. So talk about wrong action going on here. And so I got engaged to this person, and just to give you an idea of how wrong this was, when I came home one day to find him beating my dog with a curtain rod, and I got in the middle of it and found myself getting hit with it as well, I finally realized that this was not the right person to be engaged to and to get married to. And thank God, I packed everything in my little Honda Civic, including my dog, whatever I could fit into in my car, and when I finally had that moment of clarity, I also had someone on the phone, my sister. You know, God doesn't call the equipped, he equips the called. And that in that moment, she said to me, if you think that man can is going to hit that dog, what do you think he's going to do to you and your children? You pack up and you get the F out of there. And that's what I did in that moment of divine clarity, if you will. And I packed up my little Honda Civic and I moved back from Michigan back to Maryland. And there have been people who are probably on the phone right now who have gone went through that whole process with me. And God bless you all for sticking with me on that one, because I got married 2 years later to the right man and I'm still married to him 27 years later. So this is things that this program has taught me, that the discomfort of waiting is a lot better than the pain of jumping compulsively into something else. It doesn't mean I always work this program perfectly, but it means there is a way to work it. There is right action that I can do. Again, going back to page 317, again, not in the first 164 pages, so please don't smack me here. It says, when I'm willing to do the right thing, I am rewarded with an inner peace no amount of liquor could ever provide. When I am unwilling to do the right thing, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. We also call that the RIDS. I also heard it the other day, itchy, bitchy, and twitchy. I become restless, irritable, and discontent, or itchy, bitchy, and twitchy. It is always my choice. Through the 20s, sorry, Mary, I got that recording again. Yeah, I beg your pardon. I keep getting this recording in my ear telling me that I'm muted, but I think I'm still here, right? Am I back?
You are. You are, Amy.
Okay. Okay, phew. Let me just go back. When I am unwilling to do the right thing, I become restless, irritable, and discontent. It is always my choice. Through the 12 steps, I have been granted the gift of choice. I am now no longer at the mercy of a disease that tells me the only answer is to drink. If willingness is the key to unlock the gates of hell, it is action, and I'd like to add ongoing action, right action, that is prescribed by the first 160 pages of this book. It is action that opens the doors so that we may walk freely among the living. And as I said before, in my wildest imagining, I thought, my life would be so wonderful if the food didn't just keep calling. But what's happened instead is this program has given me a different prescription for life. I mean, I don't know about you all, but when you were young, were you like me walking around going, how did everyone else get the book of life and how life was supposed to work and I didn't get it? And now I have a new way of living. Not only does the food not call, but now I have the power of choice. Now I have been restored sanity enough to know that it's going to be my choice to act like a jerk or not, to work this program or not, right? It tells me very clearly who I am in this book and what I'm supposed to do. On page 102, it says here about my job. I just thought I had it marked, but here we go. Page 102. Your job now is to be at the place where you may be of maximum helpfulness to others. So never hesitate to go anywhere if you can be helpful. Keep on the firing line of life. With these motives, God will keep you unharmed. So one of the most important things I do in ongoing recovery is the action of service. And that's just where I'm going to wrap up. Service is the most important thing. Sponsorship. I can't even begin to tell you over the decades of recovery that I've been in how important and how life-saving sponsorship and service has been to me. It keeps me green. It keeps me grateful. It keeps me learning. That is something that is so important. You know, in those three A, B, and C's that I wrote, it says, God could and would if he were sought, not found, but sought. That's what action does for me every day. When I take the prescribed action of these 12 steps and the tools every single day, I am then seeking my higher power every day. It's like breathing to me because I am seeking my higher power every day. And when I stay connected through action, the right action to God, to my higher power, then the dilemma, the lack of power, the dilemma is no longer a dilemma for me. So the food no longer calls and the behavior becomes a choice. It becomes an internal choice that I know and choose whether I do it or not. And there goes my peace and my sanity, depending on what I do. And like I said, I don't work this program. I do take the actions, the right actions, as best as I can. I do take the bit in my teeth. And let me tell you something about the pickup man on the racetrack. When you're getting run away with at 45 miles an hour, there's something called a pickup man. And this is a man or a woman on a horse that sits on the racetrack just waiting, because everybody gets run away with on the racetrack during exercise. And so they sit there, two or three of them, all around the racetrack, waiting for the horse to get run away, waiting for the jockey or the exercise boy or girl to get run away with. So they're just waiting. And the interesting thing about that is, again, this is me getting into my horsey stuff, but there's a point to this, I promise, is a quarter horse. Thoroughbreds are known to be the fastest horses in the world at a distance, but the fastest horses in the world are a quarter horse that can go upwards of 50 to 55 miles an hour in a short distance. So they ride these little quarter horses that you would think could not do what they can do. And that's what I love about this program. I never thought that these things could happen in my life. And yet I was getting run away with by this disease, completely powerless, terrified, not knowing what to do. And here comes a 55 mile an hour, God that I could have never imagined, who comes and grabs the reins of this disease and says, "Ho, Nelly, I got you. I got you." This is an incredible program. It's a wild ride. Trust me, but if I can do it, you can do it. It is a common solution. That's what Larry was saying. It's a common solution. There's no secret code. It is the steps that are prescribed in these first 164 pages. It works. Trust me, it works. If I can do it, you can do it. And with that, I will pass. Thank you so much for letting me share.
Oh, Amy, thanks so much. Boy, you packed a lot into that. You know, it was terrific, and we appreciate you so much. We appreciate your sincerity and your beautiful recovery and sharing that with us this morning. So we're going to transition to a Q&A. We got time for a Q&A period, so think about that, about questions you may have for Amy. Questions only, please. And as soon as we get there, you're going to press star one. But before we do that, let me give you the share ID for the presentation this morning, and then I'll give it again at the end. That number is 22,171. That's 22171 for the share ID. So let's transition now. If you have a question for Amy, press star one to unmute your phone and give me your first name and last initial. Who has some questions?
Anayeta R.
Anayeta.
Sonia S. from Pennsylvania.
Sonia. Who else?
Pete B.
Hey, Pete. Gotcha. Anybody else?
Robin P. in Costa Rica.
Hey, Robin. Gotcha.
Thank you.
Ruvain H. from Israel.
Ruvain H. Who else? We pay Amy in recovery, so we got her for a few minutes of more recovery, more sobriety. Right, Amy? But we can get you set around if we got time. Who is that?
Me, F. in Tennessee.
Hey, Nick. See, now I know what Nick looks like. This is why you got to get to the new
one. Me too.
How
cool
is
that?
Right? Isn't that cool, Amy? We know Nick.
Very
this
cool.
is crazy, right? Okay, so I got Hanayeta, Sonia. We got Pete, Robin, Ruvain, Nick. Anybody else right now? Okay, we can catch you on the backside here. So let's start with, if you're not Hanayeta, would you mute your line, and then we'll follow up by Sonia. Hanayeta, what question do you have for Amy?
Thank you for your service, Larry. I just love hearing you. And Amy, I only have a couple just questions because your share was so great that I really don't have any questions. I think you answered them all. But I did get itchy, bitchy, and twitchy, which was real important. But what I didn't get is you had three D's twice. And I was wondering if you could go over those again slowly so I could write them down.
Sure. The disease of denial, delusion, and defiance. And then the other three, when you're ready for recovery, is dying, desperate, and doomed. So denial,
right.
Delusion, defiance, dying, desperate, and doomed.
Okay, thanks for the question, Hayeta. Okay, let's move on to Sonia, followed by Pete. Sonia, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Amy, for your talk. You mentioned a phrase, regulation of emotions, and that is one of the things that I realize I feel powerless over at moments. And I'm wondering, do you have like a mantra that you say? Someone just mentioned to me or reminded me of a serenity prayer, but is there a mantra that you have when you're in a situation when somebody really pushes your button?
Well, there's two. Yeah, great question. And that's why I'm saying this is an ongoing, you know, recovery is ongoing. For me, it's I feel those emotions when I'm really upset. And the first thing I have to say is God help. And my mantra is what I was saying when I was sharing earlier is God relieve me of the bondage of self. God relieve me of the bondage of self. And I have to remove myself. Sometimes I have to actually physically remove myself and just say, hey, can we talk later? Or I can't talk right now. I can't get my feelings under control. I can't hear you through my emotions, basically. Or I can't hear you through your anger. I mean, I've learned some quotes that I use. I have a mantra of prayer. Sometimes it's God help. Because I've learned now over time, particularly in ongoing relationships, that there's always a part I play. There is always a part I play. And unless I address that first, then I'm not going to get any clarity. And God has to help me do that. But I can't hear God if my emotions are not like under control. So that's what 10 steps are for too, because sometimes I do speak based on my emotions. And then I have to go back and say that what was really going on was that I was afraid, because fear is usually behind some sort of fear. You know, I was afraid that you were not seeing me or you were not hearing me or I was not being heard. And that's why I responded the way I did. So I hope that helps.
Thanks for the question, Sonia. Next up, we got Pete, followed by Robin. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning, Larry. Thank you so much for taking the meeting. And Amy, thanks for your presentation. Always super insightful and thorough. I really like how you finished with regard to the power of choice being restored and sanity being restored. So my question is this. You know, when I read in the big book, it says that step one says that we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, and these are both in past tense. And I'm wondering, is there a difference, and what's your perspective on why they're in past tense and not in present tense, indicating that we are powerless and our life is unmanageable?
Hey, Pete. So you're asking me that. I just need you to clarify. Can you repeat that question? I'm not sure I quite understand. I know we were powerless. I absolutely have been restored to sanity when it comes to compulsive overeating, but sometimes my behavior can still be wacky. So I need the program.
And so my question was, the big book says that we were powerless and our lives had become unmanageable. They're both in past tense. And I'm curious if we were powerless or we are powerless and our life is unmanageable or our life was unmanageable.
Oh, I see what you're saying. Well, to me, that's kind of, I mean, I definitely was powerless and I am powerless and I was powerless. It's both, frankly. It's both. I am no longer, you know, thrown around by this disease to the mat, as they say, thrown to the mat by this disease. But that doesn't mean my life can't become unmanageable while I'm abstinent. So pick your poison, right? Do I want to act like a dry drunk and not use these tools and these steps for this program? So past tense meaning that we've been restored to sanity. I mean, it says that, you know, we've been recovered. We are recovered. But that doesn't mean that I'm cured. I still have to deal with my disease every day. Anyways, it's both. It's both. I hope that helps.
Thanks for the question, Pete. Okay, let's move on to Robin, followed by Ruvane. Robin, good morning to you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Larry. Thank you so much, Amy. Oh, my gosh. I was just laughing and loving everything you said. Oh, my gosh. Vixie, Vixie, into a key. I'm going to remember that. And just God bless you. You've just been such a blessing. So my question is, what do you do each day for your spiritual practice? Thank you.
Oh, great question. Thanks. So this is the same, has been the same. When I get up in the morning, my spiritual disciplines is before I even stand up, I hit my knees and I'm asking God to relieve me of the bondage of self. I'm asking to be of service. I'm asking for clarity to do his will. And then I go about my day. And again, when we are itchy, bitchy, and twitchy, we pause. When I am disturbed, I pause and I ask for God's help throughout the day. My prayer life now is one of reflex, thank God, or one of such habit that I'm also, you know, always thinking about, you know, what God would be wanting me to do. I mean, not all the time. I'm not like Zen, you know, all the time. But I'm also doing my spiritual disciplines of sponsoring. I have a devotional time in the morning. I'm reading both big book literature and AA literature and sometimes OA literature. I mean, right now I'm going through with my sponsor. I'm still actively working my program. That is spiritual discipline to me, is to be active in my program. So right now I'm going through reading the fourth edition stories with my sponsor and going through them again. So I'm always doing something in the literature. And I'm always sponsoring, and I do my devotions in the morning, and then throughout the day I'll have calls from sponsees, mostly in the morning. I talk to my sponsor at night, and those disciplines also, I'm also an unabashed weigher and measurer. I've been measuring my food for 37 years. To me, that's a spiritual discipline, to have my food planned and prepared. That's a spiritual discipline. I go to meetings, regular meetings, that everyone in the family knows that on Monday night, I'm at my AA home group, Mondays and Friday nights. And it used to be going somewhere else to OA, but now I'm online or I'm on the phone. Everyone knows in the morning that I am on the phone from 7 to 8, and then I take all my sponsee calls. And I mean, that's changed over the years with children and family. I mean, I was single and unmarried when I first got recovered at 22. And so things have had to evolve and change over time. But what I like to call my spiritual disciplines is flexibility within boundaries. I know that if I don't get up in the morning and do my devotionals and do my reading and, you know, talk to my sponsees, I know that I'm not going to be as spiritually fit that day unless I do those things. And so I know that the pain of discipline or the pain of regret when it comes to that. I know that if I'm not disciplined to do my prayer and meditation, I would have to say that's probably one of the biggest things I struggle with is prayer and meditation. I go in fits and spurts for my meditation. And so I've had to find new and different ways to do my meditation to keep it fresh. So anyways, I hope that helps.
Thanks, Robin. Okay, we got Ruvane followed by Nick. Ruvane, are you in Israel there? Good morning to you.
Yeah. Yeah, so in Israel, thank you for your service and everything else here. Is just, Amy, my question is, you mentioned the 10 steps as being a very, and on meetings, I hear various ways people explore and demonstrate how they do the 10 steps. Could you tell us some details and examples about how you process the 10 step as an individual?
Hi, Ruvane. You kind of broke up a little bit, but I think you were asking about how do I do my 10 steps. Is that correct?
That's what I heard, Amy. Yeah, okay. That's what I heard. Yeah, maybe just a 10 step deal.
Hi, Ruvane. So for me, I mean, this was a long time ago, not to date myself, but I'm dating myself. But the phone was attached to the wall. Okay, so for me, in the beginning, 10 steps were not particularly formalized. It was much more organic. When I felt disturbed, I was told to pick up the phone and call someone and talk about it. That's as far as my 10-step got. But in doing that, I would talk to someone and she'd say, hey, Amy, how are you doing? I said, listen, I'm really frustrated right now. My boss is doing such and such, blah, 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 and I'm really angry. And then she would say to me, well, Amy, you know, why are you angry? You know, where are you afraid? She would basically use what it talks about in the big book of drilling down to where am I being selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid. I mean, to me, that's the ultimate of what the 10th step is about. What is my part? Where am I selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid? And then ultimately, what's the lie I'm believing? That if my boss doesn't act the way that I want him to, that I'm not okay? That if my children act in an embarrassing way, that that means that I'm a terrible mother? Like, what's the lie that I'm believing? And it always reverts to what is to those last two things for me. Now we are blessed with spiritual toolkit apps and different things that we can do that is much more formalized. There's the 11-step train. I mean, there's all these different ways that we can sit and do it formally. But for me, what's really important is the first action, which is to either pick up the pen to paper about why I'm upset, but mostly for me, it's the phone, or it's to pray. I mean, let's not forget here that, you know, God is my source of power, my higher power. So I could say if there's not a phone nearby, if there's not a pen to paper nearby, I can pray and I could say, God, relieve me of the bondage of self here. Where am I feeling selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and afraid? And ultimately, why do I believe this way? What's the lie that I'm believing? And that can happen in like 3 or 4 seconds in my brain if I'm spiritually fit. Right? When I see something that's going on. I mean, it all plays on each other. If I'm doing my spiritual disciplines, when I become disturbed, it becomes very natural for me to then automatically run through this in my brain because I've been doing it over and over and over and over and over and over and over again. Right? So I hope that helps.
Thanks for the question, Romaine. Hey, Nick, am I going to see you in Newark maybe? That'd be cool. Nick Prestar.
Hey, good morning, family. We are a good-looking bunch. Thank God for you, Larry and Amy. Absolutely. I've already registered. I will be there, definitely.
Oh, good.
So thank you, Amy, for your amazing qualification. Like, I could see pictures in my mind as you were sharing about the horse and the bit. So my question to you is, you know, how do you you know, now we get to have this spirit of self-assurance and confidence as we do this deal. How do you abstain from cockiness and arrogance? That's one question. But then my other question is now, how do you also handle calls from other people who were agnostic, as I was and as you qualified and stated you were? How do you handle those calls? So that's two questions. I hope that's clear. Thank you.
When someone calls me who's struggling with agnosticism, all I do is repeat back to them that this is a program of action and that if you trust in whom the problem has been solved, a recovered person, a recovered sponsor, that your higher power will evolve through the process of working the steps, that we act our way into a new way of believing. And that eventually, if you trust that process, and that's, we're going to get down to business. You know, step three is just meaning we're going to just take action and we're going to move through the steps. And I had to trust in that. So I just relay that same information and what my experience is, because gratefully now, that's what's so wonderful about the program is that I now have experience. And I can say, I felt that way too. I know exactly where you are. I know that agnosticism, and it is killing. It is killing, and it is devastating. you know, God, and she said to me, she said, Amy, I don't care if you think your higher power is Jesus, Buddha, or the universal vibes of a tree, as long as it isn't you and it's greater than you. We can start with that. That's all we need to do is take action. We can't let the agnosticism stand in the way of our action in these steps, or we'll die of this disease. And I beg your pardon, I just totally forgot what the first question was. Could you repeat it? Sorry.
What's the cockiness and arrogance? You know, how do we avoid, this is what I heard, Nick. Yeah, how do we avoid that? Because, you know, you're a big shot, Amy.
Oh,
come
my
on.
Gosh. No way. Listen, right. Another bozo on the bus of recovery. And that's why service and sponsorship is so important. Because, you know, I've just laid myself open to you guys. Sharing is so, and sponsorship and service, it keeps you green and grateful. Because every time I give service, every time I talk to a newcomer, every time I sponsor someone, I am reminded where I have come from. I am reminded that this was not done by me. Yes, I did a lot of praying to God and rowing to shore, right? I rowed, I did the action, but it was ultimately something greater than me. Right, that this program has done for me. And I cannot claim anything other than doing what I was told, the program as prescribed, and seeing the wonderful results of God doing for me what I could not do for myself. And when I do service, I'm constantly reminded going, wow, you know, I'm not there anymore by the grace of God. I am not that person anymore by the grace of God. I can still act in a crazy way, but I'm not where I was at age 22. Someone asked me once in about long-term recovery, what's the difference? And I say everything and nothing, right? I do the same things every day that I've done for the most part when it comes to the disciplines of this recovery program, but my life has completely changed. My life, I have been empowered to act differently. I've been restored to sanity, but it is by God's grace. And I also know that because when I don't follow spiritual disciplines, like I said, you can only coast downhill. I see myself going back to the selfish, self-centered, falling back that way. We all know that relapse, and I'll stop, sorry. We all know that relapse doesn't begin with the first bite. That's the end of a relapse. A relapse begins when the emotions are out of control, when the itchy, bitchy, and twitchy isn't addressed, when our spiritual disciplines are not being done on a daily basis. That is what starts the relapse. The bite is the end. So I am constantly reminded through service that that's not where I want to be anymore, and I have a choice today. So that's that. I hope that helps.
Yeah. I'm going to take some creative license here as the moderator and say, you know what, Nick, too, which is pretty cool, with I see with Amy and so many others that I've learned from, they don't believe the press clippings. You could see the way they act, you know, and that's beautiful recovery. They provide a great pathway for me to follow. So anyways, we have time. We're going to end a little bit early because I have a commitment here that I made, but we have time for more questions for now. If you have a question for Amy, press *1 and give me your first name and last initial.
Cindy from Boston.
Questions? Cindy. Gotcha, Cindy. Who else? Anybody else? Okay. Well, let's go with Cindy and kind of we'll see where we're at. Cindy, go ahead and give us your question. Good morning.
Okay, thank you. Amy, thank you. Congratulations on 37 years. My question is, I really liked what you said about the first thought is the first thought, but then the second thought and what I do with the thought. And my question really has to do with what if the second thought doesn't end up well, and you find yourself where now I got to make amends, or you know something, you know that you did something, you said something, whatever. How have you handled it? Thank you.
Okay, so I missed a couple words in there, but I think you were talking about when you do open your mouth and
yes.
How do you come back from it? Okay,
yes.
Gotcha.
Yes.
Well, a lot of times in the moment, if I'm clear enough and, you know, I can say, wow, that came out wrong. I'm really sorry. That was based on what was going on with my feelings right there. I apologize. That's like an immediate one. If I'm still angry and I unload on someone, I come back and I say, you know, that anger was coming from this, that, and the other. And sometimes I also have to say I felt attacked. I apologize on how I responded. I felt attacked. You know, I've learned to self-advocate in recovery, which is also very important. I'm not a doormat, so I also have to find where my part is. And I'm not saying I can fix, change, and cure someone else. But I also have to say things that are very clear, which is, I'm feeling attacked right now. I can't hear you through your anger. Can we talk at another time? Otherwise, I need to leave the room. I mean, we deal with other people every single day. So those things are very important. And say, you know, I misspoke. I understand I misspoke, but I'm feeling like I wasn't heard. So I apologize for what I said. And can we review this tomorrow when we're both clear? When we're both not angry anymore. Or I say, you know, I'm apologizing for what I said, but I still need to address what the issue was. Could we do that tomorrow? Usually tomorrow is always a good time frame. And if there are things that even more so down the road where I have to say, you know, I come back to you and I say, you know, I've been acting in a way that has been selfish and self-centered because I had an agenda. And my agenda was more important than your feelings. I've had to do that with my adult children, very humbling. And I've had to say, I apologize for that. And my agenda now is to be one of service and not be so self-centered. Will you forgive me? And that's coming close to like an amends, but that doesn't mean I can't just go ahead and address it. I don't have to wait to say, go back to my, call my sponsor, or say, okay, I need to make a formal amends. I don't need to do that now. I know how it's done. So I will turn around and I will say, wow, this last week has been about my fear and my agenda. I am sorry. And I mean, I'll just be honest with you. That's just very humbling about this program. It's like, I'm not fixed. I have a new way now and I have gotten better, but that doesn't mean I'm not using the tools that are available to me to come back and be able to say something. And then what's so cool about that is what I've done with my kids is that they say to me, you know, they start using those things too, which has been pretty cool to see that happen. Like when they're talking to each other, you know, that they'll say, I'm sorry I said that. And I'm like, wow, thank you, God. You know what I mean? I tell you, parenting is not for the faint of heart. They press every single button. But boy, how much learning do I get? I've done a lot of 10 steps. I think even more so sometimes with my adult children than with my kiddos when they were really young. But anyways, there you have it. I hope that helps.
Thanks, Cindy. So this is going to be the last call for a question for Amy. So we'll get her contact information as well after the meeting. But due to the fact that I got a commitment, I'm going to close a little bit early today. Who else has a question? Press star one.
Hi, this is Tony B.
Lisa M.
Tony. Let's go with Tony and Lisa. Was there one other person?
Anne-Marie M. Anne-Marie M.
Great. Let's close it with that. I got Tony, Lisa, and Anne-Marie. Thank you guys so much for your patience with me. Let's start with a question from Tony, followed by Lisa. Good morning, Tony.
Hi. Thank you so much, Larry. And thank you, Amy. My question is, when life starts to get quite packed with lots of sponsee things and lots of meetings, and I sometimes don't plan for just the ordinary, like, I don't know, washing up or... my question I think is about balance, and I guess that evolves over time, but could you talk to that a bit?
Sure. No, that's great, because that is something that I had to learn as well, because I couldn't, once I started having children and a family, my obligations and my priorities changed, or there had to be a better balance. And I literally did not understand. I mean, I think I had the ego that thought there was more than 24 hours a day in a day, that I should be able to do more than that. And that was my selfish self-centeredness. I wanted to be super mom, and it was killing me. And I literally, and I just say this humbly, I literally had a sponsor said, like, get a piece of paper, get one of those weekly timesheet things that says, you know, not timesheet, that says Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, lists the days, and it lists the hours, you know, the days across the top and the hours down the side. And she said, I want you to put in all of your program stuff. I want you to put your weekly schedule there, your sponsee calls, your time for food prep, your meetings, all of those things, your prayer and meditation, put all of that in, and let's see how much time that is taking away from your family. Now, it's important, of course, right? It's your oxygen mask, so it has to be there. But the question is how much? And I didn't even realize, because I'm thinking in my brain, this is where I get into trouble sometimes, I'm thinking that there are more hours to the day and that, you know, that couple of calls or that extra 30 minutes with my sponsee wasn't a problem. And maybe once in a while, but when it's taking away from me saying, telling my kids, hold on a second, I'll get you dinner in 30 minutes here, that doesn't work, right? So I had to find that balance, and putting it down on paper was a huge eye-opener to what I thought was the time I was taking was way different than what I thought. So I worked with an objective person, my sponsor, and I said, okay, where can we find some flexibility, right? So, for example, when my kids were little, my husband always knew that Monday nights I was going to my meeting. Monday nights was meeting. And if he wasn't available, he was going to call me. I would get a sitter because that was sacrosanct. That was going to be, you know, that was something that was not flexible. But in other areas, I could flex, right? I used to take my calls really, really early in the morning. And at one point, I was asked if I could do it later in the day because it was disruptive to my husband's activities. I said, okay, I can do that. I could move my calls to later in the day. I did that. So again, flexibility, understanding what the true nature of my week looked like so that I could find some balance. And I can't even begin to tell you how cool it was when I looked at it on paper, what a difference that made. And when I start to feel that way again, I go back to a calendar and I lay out my week, and then I can get a better feel for what's going on as far as my time commitments and where that balance is. And it's not a perfect ideal, I have to say. Things have had to change over time, and it doesn't always work perfectly, but it certainly helped me sort of understand where that balance point was, if you will. And I hope that helps.
Thanks, Tony. Okay, question from Lisa, followed wrapping up with Anne Marie. Lisa, good morning.
Good morning. My name is Lisa M. from Virginia. Thanks, Amy, for your lead, and thanks, Larry, for, and everybody for doing service here at the meeting. So my question is around, you know, in Jim's story, he talks about failing to enlarge his spiritual life, and I can get into sort of a maintenance or routine kind of in my spiritual life. You know, I could do my prayer and meditation in the morning. I do my tens throughout the day. I'll do my nightly review. I'll, you know, pray throughout the day. But I guess I'm curious as to how you have enlarged your spiritual life versus the maintenance, meaning for me, maintenance means staying the same versus enlarge, meaning growing it. So thanks.
Because again, it's God if he were sought, right? Not found. So it's a constant growing in my spiritual life. And that means I've tried different things. I'm being open to trying different things. For a while there, I felt very called to sponsoring people with long-term recovery, for example, because sometimes that's harder to find someone who has more time than you. I felt very called to that, and I still do, but what I also found was that I was lacking in dealing with newcomers and that I needed to revise and make time. Like I was talking about in the last question, I needed to make time for sponsoring newcomers again, because I needed a refreshing of my program. Like you're saying, I needed to grow. And I realized that I had a huge hole in my recovery it's not the whole, maybe not the right description, but that I needed to grow more again. And so now I make sure that in my sponsoring, I'm always sponsoring a bit of both. And I've also tried, like I said, myriads of different kinds of meditation, because I get really stuck in that, as far as types of used to be walking while I was riding my horse, while it's sitting still. I would say sitting still is always the hardest for me. Now there's apps that go along with my spiritual disciplines, with my religious disciplines. And that's a whole new growth that has gone on for me over the decades, is going from agnosticism to the power of the fellowship in whom those have been problem, in whom the problem had been solved, to then evolving to believing in a God, and then believing in back in the God of my religion. So there's been a path of growth that has happened over the decades. And I think one of the most important things, like you said, you don't want to be stuck in a rut or anything like that, is to be open to what God brings you. Like, my feeling is, if you're feeling like you're stuck or you want to enlarge, I would start praying about, God, please enlarge, you know, enlarge my spiritual life however you see fit. And that was a prayer that I had. And then all of a sudden I get this mind bubble, which is, you know what? I haven't sponsored a newcomer in a long time. Let me do that. And then it was like, boom, everything exploded. And I was like, wow. So my feeling is, if you pray for it too, that there is that your higher power will answer you as well. So those are just some ideas. I hope that helps.
Yeah, thanks for the question, Lisa. And we'll take the final question, because we're going to end a little bit early today, with from Anne Marie. Good morning, Anne Marie.
Hey, good morning, Larry. Thank you so much. It's Anne Marie M. in South Carolina. And thank you, Amy, for a great presentation. I just heard you mention the disciplines of the recovery process, and my mind started twirling around thinking, what exactly? Simply the tools of the program, and I'm thinking there's probably more. So what would you say the disciplines of the recovery process are? I mean, would you just say they're the tools of the program, or is there anything else added to that?
Well, there are the tools and the steps and the actions required. They are combined to me. It's not the tools versus the steps. It's both. It's the tools, the steps, the traditions, it's the actions, it's putting the food down, the disciplines of our daily recovery process that we do on a daily basis. I mean, I'm talking to people on the phone on a daily basis, I'm abstinent on a daily basis, I food prep on a daily basis, I pray on a daily basis, I meditate, working on a daily basis, I do devotionals on a daily basis. So, you know, I'm doing service on a daily basis. I attend regular meetings. I do service at those meetings. So the disciplines are, you know, I have a wonderful life within certain boundaries, right? So my feeling is, like, if I know I'm an addict, I'm an addict, you know, through and through. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm an addict in mind. I have been recovered, but I also know that I have limitations. Meaning that I don't eat certain foods, meaning that I won't do certain things if I'm not comfortable with those certain things. So I have this flexibility within boundaries, and those spiritual disciplines are what keep those boundaries in place. The disciplines of the program are what keep me safe and abstinent and sane within a wonderfully, wonderfully full life. But I also know that there are things that I won't do because I don't eat certain foods. I don't go to certain places. I don't do those things. And I don't miss my spiritual disciplines on a daily basis, because I know that that's how I live a wonderful life within those boundaries. I hope that gives you more clarification and that helps.
Yeah, thanks so much for that final question, Anne-Marie. And Amy, thank you so much. You were just a beautiful, we're so appreciative, beautiful presentation. We're so appreciative of the generous use of your time this morning. And so hang out, because once we close the meeting and end the recorded portion, we will ask Amy for her contact information if you care to reach out to her. And let me give the share ID number again for this morning's presentation. That number is 22,171. That's 22171. So we're now going to close from a reading from the big book, from our namesake here in a chapter called The Vision for You, Vision for You, on page 164. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until